You're listening to Food Trucks in Babylon, a Western Seminary podcast with Dr. Todd Miles and Dr. Patrick Schreiner. Listen as they discuss matters of faith, theology, and culture in a post-Christian world.
Hey, this is Patrick.
And this is Todd.
And today we're joined by Drew Johnson. Drew teaches at the King's College in New York City. You are the Associate Professor of Biblical and Theological Studies, and I think this is new, the Director of Center for Hebraic Thought. Is that new?
Just started this year.
Great. So what's the goal of that?
That is to do what Robert Alter did for the literary understanding of Scripture on the philosophical side, the intellectual world of Scripture.
Nice.
That it's just as savvy in its thinking as it is in its literary artistry.
Yeah. You might know Drew's voice from the On Script podcast as well, one of your claim to fames. You're infamous now because of that. I listen to the On Script podcast all the time. Found it really helpful. So
Drew's... I listen to it all the time as well. Not the episodes I'm in, but I listen to all the other ones. I love it.
Yeah. So he's one of the hosts. And I heard of Drew before he came on Script, and he's written a lot about knowing, kind of a philosophy. I guess that's what you describe it, kind of a philosophy of knowing.
Of the Bible, yeah.
And then you've written a lot about, it's epistemology. And then human rights or rituals or kind of liturgical type ideas. And so Drew's most recent book is Human Rights, The Power of Rituals, Habits, and Sacraments. And so we're going to spend some of our time at least speaking about human rights and rituals. We'll probably get into knowing, biblical knowing, a little bit. But let me just begin by asking, what got you into this type of study? Why were you drawn to this?
Initially, when I finished my undergrad, I was a new Christian, had a day and night conversion experience, and my undergrad was in psychology. I was TAing research methods, statistical methods. I was really interested in like how we know things as scientists, and specifically research psychology, like the more clinical side of psychology. A friend talked me into going to seminary. I went to seminary, and I read a guy named Michael Polanyi, and all the doors were blown off. Mm-hmm. I'd never heard any of this before in all my scientific training, I couldn't figure out why. And I met this woman named Esther Meek, and we had these long conversations about epistemology. Yeah, she was one of my mentors throughout seminary.
Making sense now. I didn't know that connection. Doesn't she have a book like Covenantal Note? What is it?
Longing to Know, Loving to Know.
Yeah.
There's a little, book on knowledge or something. Yeah, fantastic. She's a wonderful human being and a wonderful philosopher. And actually, because of that contact with her, after I finished seminary, I started working as a pastor, and I did a MA in analytic philosophy because I wanted to know more about philosophy, and then realized that I was done with philosophy at that point. It was good learning, but I didn't need to do any more. But so that's I always had these questions about how do you know things confidently?
Yeah.
And I thought scientists did, and then when upon reading Polanyi, that kind of pushed it into another realm of there aren't just facts out there to be known. And, and seminary also pushed these issues with me. And so as I went through, I saw Scripture. I was interested in these questions about what does Scripture say about knowing? And I'd hear these things like, we just have to have faith. And then my non-Christian friends would say, it's just religious blind faith. Mm-hmm. And I'd be reading Scripture going, nobody blindly believes anything. In fact, God never asked anybody to do anything without giving them historically veracious reasons first, you know? And so this, the notion of faith and trust and knowing and confidence in knowing, these were all just constantly boiling up in me. I don't know why I was so interested in them, but I mean, I could probably psychologize myself as a child and figure out some family biography stuff.
That's what we need here.
But being
we have a great counseling center here, actually, if you want to visit afterwards.
I think I've been shot down by girls enough where I thought I knew what this girl thought, and then I realized I hadn't. And so that created this desire to know.
Great. Todd, do you want to jump in with a question here?
Yeah, well, in your latest book, that Human Rights, it also seems like your military background is just constantly intersecting in how you know what you know, and then how even to react, and how much knowing goes into that as well.
Yeah. If Funny enough, there were two more military stories in there, which the editors like strip them out.
I like those.
Yeah, I know. I failed out of high school at 16, joined the Air Force Reserves at 17, was active duty for a couple of years, and then spent a lot of time working in counter narcotics in South America and the Amazon in Colombia. And obviously, as a 17, 18, 19 year old, I did that for 7 years total, and that just is very formative. And you know, I saw things, I did things that I didn't think humans would do. I saw other things that humans wouldn't do. I didn't think humans were capable of doing. And actually it's kind of what led me to God, eventually, is it kind of crushed any hope I had in humanity. So it was so formative. And then of course boot camp was just like this massive religious experience. I wasn't a Christian, but I just remember thinking I had all these romantic ideas about it, which all were shattered within the first night or two.
This long epistemological experiment.
Like, how do you take an 18-year-old and get them? I mean, how do you take a group of eight? I mean, just think about this for a second. I hand you a group of 18-year-old young men, and I say, like, look, I need you to get them in 8 weeks. I need you to get these young men to the point where they are doing precision maneuvers together. And people will die if they don't do them correctly. How do you do that? And they have this whole regimented series of maneuvers they put your body through. You don't understand 90% of them.
Really?
It's Mr. Miyagi, wax on, wax off. You don't know why you're doing what you're doing. When you go through it and you look back, you go, that's why they made us like stand funny and pick up a fork funny and, you know, do all these weird things and clean our weapons in certain ways. But the idea that you can see through it, that you can just rationalize, like, okay, these are just all symbolic exercises. I just need to decode the symbology and I'll somehow. That all was shattered. So when I came into Christian theology and saw people trying to make those kind of moves, like, this is just symbolic. You just have to decode the symbology and then you'll figure out what communion is, what baptism is. I could just intuitively see that doesn't seem right. That doesn't even seem to work. And that explains a lot of the long arguments that seem to go nowhere in sacramental theology for me. So I started reading ritual theory, and anthropologists actually have been working on this for a while. And I think they had some good ideas that, lo and behold, I think were always there in scripture itself, that the anthropologists have tapped into.
Yeah. Sometimes it's helpful to step out of our field and gain wisdom from someone else and then come back to your field and just opens your eyes to new
atheist
things.
At that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, So in this book, you begin by kind of, more or less saying people don't like to think they're ritual people, but really we are all ritual people. Can you give us some examples of what you mean by that and what this kind of teaches us about who we are as human beings?
Yeah. So I think we all understand we have routines, like bathroom routines or bedtime routines. My kids are teenagers, so we don't really have the bedtime routines have changed significantly since they were young kids.
Right? Yeah, I totally understand.
Actually, funny enough, my kids are so old that I go to bed and go to sleep, and they wake me up and say goodnight. We pray for them, you know.
It switched.
And it completely switched. And soon they're going to be changing my diapers, I guess, too. So,
so it goes.
Yeah. But, I think once I had this conceptual shift about ritual, that ritual is not some strange, bizarre, cultic thing that we do, but it's kind of imbued into everything we do. I couldn't not see it everywhere. But I think you do have to draw some lines. You have to say something like brushing teeth is a ritual of sorts, but it's not the same as communion. There's something different. Mm-hmm. And so James K. A. Smith has used the term liturgies for a lot of this. And I think his work is so good. And I think liturgies does a lot of work. But he's actually using the word liturgy the way anthropologists use the word ritual.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I would say liturgies are a subset of ritual. Ritual is the big thing that helps me understand why washing my hands with antibacterial soap, which I no longer do, but why we all did for a long time, why repetitively washing your hands throughout the day is a ritual and in some way is connected to taking communion. That there's an ordinary practice that's been strategically changed in some way that in order that you might see the world differently. So there's no world in which I see germs, but it's because of germ theory and trusting scientists that I'm taught to wash my hands regularly, faithfully, even though I actually have no evidence personally of its efficacy. I can't point to my lack of sickness because I wash my hands or my lack of dysentery, but I do it because I've been habituated into doing it. I do it in order to understand
by some sort of authority outside of yourself.
Somebody had to guide me to do it, right?
Okay, and so that's the difference between just like a personal habit.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think that's right. A lot of habits have kind of authorities hanging around. So brushing your teeth.
Yeah.
Like there's all this in the media, even toothpaste ads, right? The three out of four doctors recommend. I always, in class, I always, though, show old cigarette ads. Like three out of four doctors recommend Pall Mall cigarettes,
yes,
you know?
Right.
Or,
right.
Yeah. So there's always somebody who's structuring some of it. Your parents structured a lot of this into you when you're a kid. But I think you do have to delineate who you're listening to when and what are they telling you to do. The phrase that actually a student handed me is, it's a ritual eat, ritual world. I repeat it in there a couple times. Like everybody is trying to get, it's who can get whom to do what with their bodies. Everybody's trying to get somebody to do something with their bodies. Marketing agencies, universities, parents. And the question is, what is their end? What's the goal? Is it for health and community, or is it to sell you something to make more money, to get you on an app so you stay on there longer and they make money? And obviously, anything money motivated, we're going to have to like at least question
right.
a little bit.
Right, yeah. right. I've actually heard, I probably shouldn't bring this up, but I already started. I've got to keep going. That there's kind of a conspiracy even with the toothpaste thing. Have you read about this?
No, but it wouldn't surprise me at all.
With the mint and even the flavor.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And like the totally bubbles, it's totally, oh, yeah. like, they're just like.
In China, they use completely different flavors.
Yeah, so it's like it just gets in your mind that that's the clean
The menthol feel. But, feels
yeah, hard time marketing, the hard time getting us to brush our teeth
that was
until
it.
They made it.
Yeah.
Oh, hey.
I can one-up that
one.
Minty
fresh.
Okay.
I actually wrote an essay for Erdmann's for the blog promoting the book on hydration. And the idea that you need to drink 8 glasses of water a day.
Yep.
It's not true at all.
really?
So like go on the national, don't listen to me because everybody's going to be
Why
like,
do
this
I have
is not
this?
True. Go on the National Institutes of Health and look at the research on hydration. And National Institutes of Health is now trying to get people to quit drinking so much water because it causes like athletically related deaths of people trying to hydrate.
Really?
Yeah, it's actually a health issue.
Yeah.
It doesn't hurt you to drink water. Yeah, everybody's hiding their mind.
You got Gatorade. You're fine.
I do.
But they publish things like in the articles where they're trying to convince people you don't have to drink as much water. They're saying, look, a hot potato, baked potato has 80% water in it. Pepperoni, 30% water. A bread, 30% water. Mm. You're getting water through all these sources.
Right.
So you have to ask, why have I been told, well, I'm from the 70s and 80s, so this wasn't a thing when I was a kid, but somewhere in the 90s, it was water, 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 water.
Well, I remember in gyms, they'd be like, these are the, I mean, they'd have the amount of glasses up and be like, drink this much a day. I mean, it's right
they
above
the water.
Did not
do that when I was in school, but it became a thing. And you
when
have
they started
to start,
bottling water.
They started bottling water.
Is that it?
Coca-Cola
Is that really
now sells more water than it does any carbonated beverage. Yeah.
So what you're saying is that at gyms, they should have like pepperoni sticks. You can rehydrate with pepperoni sticks.
I'm not
I think
that
I'd
kind
all
of a
be
doctor.
In on that one.
This we're just going to name this episode Don't Trust Anything You Hear.
Except this.
But again,
except this podcast.
The same one is with milk and strong bones. It's simply just, it's not true that milk makes your bones stronger. It's you get calcium in everything.
I still want to believe that, though, because I believed it for so much of my life.
but remember those Got Milk ads?
Yep, yeah. No, the milk
American
thing.
Dairy Council, right?
Yep, exactly.
It's people who are selling you milk.
Yeah.
So you can tentatively trust things, but investigate. Right.
Right.
Trust, but
right.
confirm. Somebody said that one time.
So,
like a president.
Yeah, maybe one of them.
We're all ritualed people, but there's a sense in which it seems like millennials are flocking to more of this, at least coming out of like the low church.
Yeah, yeah.
Flocking to more like liturgy in church. What do you attribute that to? Is that just reactional? Is that trying to, or is that something that you think maybe people realize, man, this was really missing in terms of maybe more structured, tilting into more high church kind of ways of being in the body of Christ. You have any thoughts about that?
I do. I think my personal so I'm in New York City, and we get students from across the country, and the ones from California, this is one thing, I don't know if it's true of Oregon and Washington, but the ones from California, they all say, I didn't know what a denomination was until I came to New York City.
That'd be fair.
I think
everyone's here non-denominational,
which they
just mean we don't associate with anybody.
Yeah. So for a lot of them, they learn Christian history, Christian theology, biblical studies, and they only get intro courses in all these at our college. But it's enough, and they're going to like an Anglican church for the first time and going like, wait, why do they do that? And people go, well, what do they do back at your church? And they're like, they just have Wonder Bread up there, like in the bag, and you just take some out, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And they're starting to question all of these things. And so I don't think it's actually.
My pastor has cool sneakers or something like that.
I don't think for many of the millennials. Gen Zs might be different because maybe the Gen Zs haven't hit you guys yet, but 3 years ago we started getting them and it was a distinct shift away from millennials.
Interesting. Yeah.
But for the millennials, it seemed to be they wanted something more ancient and connected to the early church.
Yeah.
And then along with that came the sacraments. But I don't think they were looking for a sacramental life. I think they were kind of questioning, wait, why when I go to these more antiquity-oriented denominations, why are they all high on the body and smells and bells and all this other stuff? And I think it just caused them to question. And then you have someone like me jumping up and down going, the body matters. Yeah. God created you as body. He wants to put your body through paces so that you know the world in some way. And so I think that's where I see it.
Okay.
Well, that brings up an interesting point because you do speak about how important for ritual just our embodiment is. So what do you make of virtual reality, social media, virtual communities, maybe even something like distance learning through, I mean, it seems like so many vital parts of what we do, we're no longer embodied.
Yeah, really. OnScript does through phone interviews. Don't write that, don't they?
No, ours are all on Skype.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that's not.
They sound like phone connections.
I'm just saying it's not embodied.
When you're dealing with a scholar in front of their laptop, you take whatever audio they get.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, it is through Skype. And it is different than we're sitting across the table for now. You can feel the difference, right? The otherness of just somebody else's presence in the room with you. Yeah, I worry heavily about all of this. Virtual reality is the one where I'm just like, this seems like it's, I mean, Black Mirror has entire episodes dedicated to the over-the-horizon problems on virtual reality because it really is taking over your sensory input. I think I tell my students, like, for me, I didn't get a cell phone until 8 years ago, and then I just got a smartphone 2 years ago for the first time. And I say, like, this is an object. If I want to use the phone, I go over, I keep it in my bag, I go over and pick it up. When I travel, I keep it on me, you know, for obvious reasons. But for them, it's not really an object that's separable from them. It's a way of connecting to the world and to their friends, and it's constantly going off, and it's remapping. It's like they have phantom tech syndrome. I don't know if you've heard of this.
I have heard of this, yeah.
Because their neurology has mapped that phone in their pocket.
I'll admit, I think I've had one or two of those.
Yeah, it happened, right? I have a psychology degree. You randomly reinforce something, that's the best way to get you to react to it or to do what you want people to do. So again, I think all of these, it's kind of for good or for ill. I've actually heard of some really good trauma therapy techniques using virtual reality for both post-traumatic stress and also just kind of long-term stress. So I think it's who is trying to get you to do what you're with your body. If there's been people who've said, look, for post-traumatic stress, there's a post-traumatic stress EMDR therapy, which I talk about in the book. It's waving a lighted wand back and forth or waving your finger back and forth.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Yeah, it's very strange, right? But it works. And the only reason you would ask somebody to do that, you wouldn't waste somebody's time or especially their emotion, you know, their emotional states, unless you actually thought this is for your good. This is for your wholeness and your health. So when I see something like VR or online education, my first question is, who wants you to do it? And is it for you? Or is it co-opting you for some other purpose?
Same thing for church too.
Absolutely. Yep. And I think, I haven't been a full-time pastor for a long time now, but I think if I ever went back into the pastorate, you know, like when I eventually get fired from my job at King's.
Right. After this interview.
After this interview.
We're doing what we can here.
I think I will think almost entirely about my parishioners' lives as like, what am I asking them to do with their bodies? Why? Towards what end? How confident am I of what I ask them to do is going to work in some way, that it's for their benefit? Same thing with the class. I used to think all content. What content am I going to get through this semester? And now I think of a semester-long class as, what am I going to ask them to do with their time, their energy, their bodies, their emotional energy? What am I going to ask them to do as homework at home? And I'm actually visualizing them. Like, what do I physically want? What posture do I want them in front of a laptop? Do I want them in front of paper? And that has radically changed the way I treat them in class and the way I structure assignments. So I use a lot more art and film and story now because of that. So.
That's good. So you maybe just more foundationally in the book, you distinguish between three different types of rituals. if you remember that.
Authoritative sources for ritual.
Yeah. Okay. Where can you just identify those? What are these? If you recall.
That is a test on your
own. Yeah. I mean, how many times have you been asked something and you're like, they're about a book you've written, and then you go like, what did I put in that book?
That's right. It was like 2 years ago. Yeah,
exactly. By the time the book's come out, you're like onto something else. Yeah, you know, you're like, I'm working on
this. And you don't even want to look at that book again.
Exactly.
I think I talked about sources of rituals. They either come from just natural interactions with the world. Mm-hmm. They come from somebody who knows, who scripted it out for you, and then God. Right. Some people have critiqued that aspect. I should point out, this is a trade book, which means it's meant for like anybody from my mom to, you know, the guy on the street who just walks into Barnes and Noble and says, oh, this looks interesting. So there's a lot of things I couldn't talk about.
Yeah.
And the editor was very wise. She would just say like, oh, nope, we got to strip it out. It's too technical. Mm-hmm. We want to keep this where anybody can reach it. So I pared it down to those three categories for this book in conversations with some theologian friends of mine. Because I want to say, look, the one that interested me is a barbershop, or not barbershop. Well, barbershop would work too, or a slaughterhouse. Like, if you're doing something, I used to work on a radar system, right? And there's all kinds of ways you can get killed on that thing. And you see, actually, anthropologists have studied this. There's fantastic studies on how scientists work around high-powered laser systems at Los Alamos and stuff. They found the Levitical model of priesthood by Mary Douglas is the best analogy for how those people act. Because they have all these weird rituals where they set up interlocks and signs, and they have all these dirty and clean profiles that they use. But it's all to not get killed, essentially, by the high-powered lasers, right? So there's something about just working around dangerous equipment that you'll just naturally develop safety protocols. And here's the turn. So doing something, you'll naturally develop these habits that'll turn into routines that sometimes turn into a ritual. It's when you turn and then say your kid comes to work with you and you say, okay, now you have to step really high over this thing, or you start scripting it out for other people. I think that's where you go from this habits and routines into the world of ritual, where you have an authority who says, trust me, I've been doing this for a while. I know what happens when you do it this way. If you want to think about it, it's the difference between Mr. Miyagi's own personal knowledge of karate or karate. And when he tells Daniel's son, okay, I need you to wax the car, wax on, wax off.
Right.
And it's that move that I think is important there. And then God uses all the same rubrics, but what does he do? He authenticates prophets thoroughly, like even Jesus. I mean, think about, you're a gospel guy. Like, how much time does Jesus spend authenticating himself to the people around him? In order that when he asked them to do weird things, like be first shall be last, you're all going to pick up your cross and die.
Right.
Like that you trust him to do these things because it is for the sake of something that is worth it. So so I think the trick with the ritual scripted by God is he's not just saying jump and we say how high. He actually says, okay, let me earn some credibility with you, which I think this is great for teaching, parenting, spousing, earning credibility first on the front end. Because I'm going to need to ask you to do things that are going to be difficult to see why I'm asking you to do these. But by doing it this way that I'm asking you to do it, you'll eventually come to be able to see the thing that I'm trying to show you. And here's the kicker. If you don't, you won't. Like, you're logically separated from ever understanding this thing I'm trying to show you if you don't trust me. So the idea that God spends so much time building trust with Israel and Jesus, with his disciples, I think it's key for how rituals are supposed to work.
So those distinctions, are you just driving like purpose of those distinctions just to get us to identify the source of where these are coming from? Is that the main purpose?
Because eventually the end of the book is I want to help people itemize. Evaluate. What are they doing for what reason? Right. And so, I was trying to give them a little rubric. It was in a conversation with a friend, Mike Rhodes, who he said, this is what you're saying. Why don't you just divide it up that way? And I was like, okay, that's a good way to think about it. I don't think simple anything, so... Mm-hmm.
Well, this has been great. We're going to continue talking about rituals and how they apply to the church life and our own personal lives right after this break.
Hi. My name's Amanda, and I'm in the Master's of Biblical and Theological Studies at Western Seminary. I love how the course readings and assignments challenge and transform my personal faith in Jesus. Unpacking scripture on an academic level has given me a deeper desire to understand what God was saying then and how his word is still life-giving today. I've also greatly valued the relationships with the faculty I've developed, taken time to build trust with me and speak into my life on a personal level. Western Seminary offers graduate, postgraduate, and certificate programs to train students with a biblical core of conviction that seeks gospel-centered transformation in your life and the lives of those you serve. If you are interested in learning more about Western or starting your application, visit us online at westernseminary.edu. Now back to the show.
Okay, welcome back. We're still talking to Drew Johnson, and I was just thinking about Christianity, and I think I've read somewhere, it was probably N.T. Wright or Wayne Meeks, that's who, at least who I'm identifying with, that when Christianity was rising, I'm not trying to make a statement about Christianity and Judaism, but as it was arising kind of in the New Testament and Gentiles were coming in, that one of the things that distinguished Christianity was that it actually wasn't very ritualistic. And so if you look at the other religions, I understand, mm-hmm. in quotes, of ancient Near East or first century, that really they were defined by what they did, and Christianity, in quotation marks, right. came around and was more defined by even thoughts and beliefs, and that distinguished it from other beliefs or religions at that time. So what they were getting at was this actually made it distinct, and that actually in the New Testament compared to even the Old Testament, I mean, you think about Leviticus, you think about mm-hmm. the law. I mean, this is how you're to act here and here and here and here. When you come to the New Testament, you kind of get like love one another and be...
Boo.
right? And not very specific commands, though, in terms yeah. of like even... depending what tradition you come out of, like, how do you do church? How do you do this stuff? I mean, the rituals that at least the church has grabbed onto, the sacraments, yeah. is baptism, Lord's Supper, at least from the yeah. more Protestant view. So I guess my question is, how do you think through that in terms of, do you agree with that assessment, maybe?
No, I do not agree.
don't agree, yeah.
It sounds so good on yeah. the face of it.
Right.
And I have to talk to Tom. I'm going to be in St. Andrews
I don't know
week.
If it was him.
Oh, no, he's moved now. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, he's gone.
But I'll talk to him. Actually, I'll be in Oxford next week, so I'll talk to him.
Talk to him for me.
Did you really say? No.
Talk to him about some other things, too.
I love Tom.
I do, too.
I think the problem with that assessment is, A, it doesn't understand the ancient Israelite religion. I'm going to separate out now the ancient Israelite religion that Jesus, Paul, and everybody prior to them practiced from Judaism, which is the sibling religion that emerges mm-hmm. after the destruction of the temple and the Bar Kokhba revolution.
Right.
So what you said about moving to the world of thought and prayer, that's actually Maimonides' assessment of where God always wanted to take Hebrews, mm-hmm. Maimonides in Mishneh Torah and the guide, he alludes to this, and then he comes out and says it directly. Back in the days of our ancestors, mm-hmm. when we were thugs, basically, God had to speak in the language of brutality, violence, and blood, and animals and sacrifice. But now he's gotten us to the point where he always wanted us to be, to the world of, he says, to the world of thought and prayer.
Interesting.
And so synagogal rabbinic Judaism, it was where he was headed with the whole train the entire time. Which is funny because it's like a principally supersessionistic view that God was always trying to get rid of this whole roadshow called the temple.
Right.
So there's some way in which Christians can affirm something about that.
Right.
But here's where I would push back. How often did your typical Israelite go to the temple and offer a sacrifice? Real question. I mean, have you ever
like
heard?
A typical?
Yeah. Like in a given year, how many times are they going down and offering a cultic sacrifice at the temple?
Well, they made what, like three pilgrims?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Three times a year, which right. is probably the only times they're eating meat as well. If you read a lot of the agrarian subsistence literature in Bronze and Iron Age. So I think we get stuck in the shiny object reading. Like we read Leviticus and we're like, oh, every time you commit a sin, you must have gone to the temple. Mm-hmm. And actually, no, it was a part of their festival cycle. So there is a relationship between them gathering as the tribes of Israel, offering sacrifices for forgiveness. For relating to the priest, for relating to God. But what Jesus does, I mean, when you talk about baptism is not a New Testament ritual.
Yeah.
And in my monograph on ritual by knowledge by ritual, I kind of walk through the seven different baptisms in scripture that all have kind of different features and goals in them. But if you think about it, if you're a first century Jew, Jesus takes what you would consider a weekly activity, a mikveh baptism, mm-hmm. before you go into the synagogue, and he turns it into a once-in-a-life event, mm-hmm. which, again, mm-hmm. it's hard for me not to relate that to circumcision in some way, mm. right? And Paul seems to in Colossians, right? And then he takes the Passover ceremony, which is a once-a-year mm-hmm. ceremony, mm-hmm. and he sabotages it. Okay, so Tom Wright got mad at me when I said that. He's like, well, we don't know that they did it every week, but they did it around weekly or bi-weekly, or they did it regularly, right? And so you have to ask, what is he doing with these rituals? Like, what's the purpose of taking a weekly activity and turning it into a once-in-a-life and taking a yearly activity, in fact, a high holy day, and turning it into a regulative, habituated practice? Mm-hmm. So to take that view of like what actually happened on the ground of rituals, the daily life of an Israelite who was a Jew who became a Christian mm-hmm. and joined in this new sect, it actually to me sounds highly ritualized.
Gotcha.
And
so it's re-ritualized in different ways.
Yeah, okay.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's re-ritualized rituals.
Re-ritualized is the term you used throughout your book.
Oh, did I? Okay, yeah. That's a good word.
I thought
I just made that up. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know.
I think so.
I should have.
Let's just say that I did. Yeah,
yeah.
We'll give you credit for that.
Yeah. So he's taking these rituals. He's re-ritualizing, which says several things, like that. That the rituals of the Hebrew Bible don't get thrown away; they get caught up, regathered, and brought to this new point. Yeah. That they weren't worthless. They weren't. Mm. God wasn't actually trying to get away from these. It's the point that the author of the Hebrews, the Epistle to the Hebrews, makes, that it was because you participate in all of these rituals, you should be able to understand who this Christ is and what He's done for you, right?
Right.
Not despite the fact that you participate in these rituals.
So, go ahead. Just a quick question: do you think?
You got me all on my diatribe here.
No, that's good. I'm just rethinking some texts. I wonder if some of the texts that we think he's throwing away these rituals and the Pharisees and the scribes and Sadducees are getting mad that he's re-ritualizing them and they're upset because he's changing them. Does that make sense?
Maybe some of the texts
we should read in that way rather than, okay, Sabbath is completely gone.
Right.
It's that actually shifting your understanding of Sabbath or whatever.
Or bringing you back to an understanding of Sabbath, right? Yep. The Sabbath is for man, not man for Sabbath, right?
Right.
And Sabbath is an interesting, well, we can talk about this however you want, but this idea that these marriage and Sabbath, these highly improvised rituals, right? Which my Jewish friends have pointed out to me and my Messianic Jewish friends have been careful to point out to me something I'd missed or misunderstood, which is... it's not that he's throwing away Sabbath or he's just destroying it, but that he's saying, look, it's not that he's throwing away Pharisaical rules and traditions that have, if you think of the, you tithe mint, dill, and cumin, he doesn't say, so quit tithing mint, dill, and cumin.
Right. Yeah.
Somebody at some point said, okay, we have to tithe a certain amount. Does that include our spices? And then somebody else said, yeah, probably should, just to be on the safe side, right? He doesn't say quit doing it. He said, you do this, but you're a hypocrite because you don't apply it consistently across your entire ritualized life.
You should have done the greater thing without ignoring the latter.
Yeah, and the latter actually should, in some ways, if you were trying to integrate, like Psalm 1, oh, happy is the man who is meditating day and night on the Torah, then tithing mint, dill, and cumin should have helped you understand this other thing. Right. Mm-hmm. It should have actually opened your eyes to this. Mm. That's where he uses the hypocrite language very strongly, as my friend Jonathan Pennington reminds me. So,
Do you, in terms of like the rituals, sacraments of baptism, Lord's Supper, if we just focus on those for a minute, you talk a lot about improvisation of rituals.
Mm-hmm. Well, pause for just a second. Let me just ask this to clarify for the people who are listening. What's the difference between a sacrament and a ritual?
There you go.
That's a great question. How would you answer that question, Todd?
Well,
back to you, Todd.
I would appeal to something you said that it is scripted for us by God.
Okay.
All right. And there's probably some sort of grace that is conveyed, although what kind?
Yeah.
People argue about. But then there's grace conveyed through a lot of different things. Yeah. But I suppose that's kind of what sacrament is getting at.
Yeah, I think some that, sort of that sacra contains. Part is yeah. that there's something sacred going on here. Catherine Bell, who's one of these anthropologists who I lean into her work quite a bit, her favorite line, I think I repeat it in this book, but, you know, someone who is kneeling in prayer to God is not like exhibiting what we call penitence, I guess, right? Yeah. Someone who's praying for forgiveness to God. If they're kneeling when they're praying, it's not that they're like exhibiting a penitence. The kneeling in prayer creates a penitent prayer.
Okay.
And so there's this kind of...
So by getting in the posture of right. penitence...
So there's this kind of form creating. And structure and sacredness to it because it's between you and God. Now, there's not a single command that I can think of that you should pray to God, that you should even pray for forgiveness. It's obviously part of the wisdom of everything that's being taught. But this idea that the form, the structure, and that it's not merely, this is the kind of the inner-outer problem, that we think the real us is down inside and the outside us is just the stage on which all the play happens, right? But I think that that's getting at what the sacred part is when we enter the territory where God is guiding us in his wisdom to do certain things with our bodies, and he seems to have sacred spaces, and you get priesthood involved. Mm-hmm. I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about this, but I tell my students, like, the most radical conceptual break in the New Testament is the movement of God's presence from the temple into us as individuals by his Spirit, because it breaks lots of metaphysical boundaries. Mm-hmm. The priesthood is mixed in there.
Yeah.
And he creates this new sacred space within us,
right.
which means that sacrament has now this kind of community and individual function mutually functioning together. So, yeah, I don't think I ever draw a hard line on what creates a sacrament or what delineates a sacrament, but it's got to be something where the sacred space, sacred activities traditionally associated with priesthood, something you have to do, you can't, like, there's no option. You have to keep Sabbath. Of course, Americans don't do this, but technically you're supposed to keep some kind of Sabbath in your life, and technically you're supposed to do communion regularly. And that this is part of how God is forming you to be his people, to see justice, to see his righteousness. And yeah. I don't want to get any more specific than that because, well, maybe there's a way we could. I haven't ever gotten there.
Mm. So I have other questions that in terms of improvisation, but I want to camp a little bit on it's not only when we kneel down that we're expressing something, but it's actually, how did you put it? Like it's causing us to...
Yeah.
be submissive or
it creates something. Submissive prayer.
So you said in the book that you grew up in, like, apply this to the church. Well, you grew up in a charismatic church.
I did not grow up in one. Became a Christian.
You became a Christian
at 20 when I was
Okay.
Big difference.
How do you think through stuff like, I mean, do you raise Don't your hand in church to create like some sort of felt sense of worship?
Yeah.
Or do you only do that when you feel that and you know what I mean? Like
yeah.
walking through those issues in terms even of how we worship. And I'm not trying to think so individually, but even as a body, like as a pastor, how do you form, like if you're into this embodied sense of it, how do you form your people in terms of like we're going to all do this together because not only is it going to express something, but it'll create this feeling in you.
Yeah.
But then some people would be like, well, that's fake. Like I'm not feeling that. I don't want to do that.
Unless I assent to it and think it's right.
Right.
And then I choose to do it. That's when it becomes spiritual.
I went to the raising of hands. Sorry.
Yeah. No, anytime I'm at a new church and they ask who's new here, I always raise my hand.
Yeah.
So that's my worship.
I didn't know it was a charismatic church, but here I am.
Do you also do that for like, who wants to be baptized? Baptized
every single time I'm in a Baptist church.
I want to be baptized again.
Yeah, I go to all the altar calls. I think it's actually one of the things because I pastored in a charismatic church as well, and I think it's one of the things I appreciated about the charismatic tradition is that they actually include the body in everything that the church does. I think there's a reticence. I even feel it too when a worship leader says, like, let's all stand up and raise our hands. I'm like, don't tell me what to do.
Right.
And then I think if they said, let's bow our heads and pray, I'm just like, oh, yes, of course, right?
Right,
We have this weird disunified view of what you should do with your body and what someone can tell you to do with your body. Or, you know, people get really, this one I've thought through a lot is people get really offended at the idea that music can have a sentimental sweep to it. Like music can move us emotionally, and that and that can happen with worship music. Yeah.
It's
and like, so we get really like touchy about music. That. Yeah. Like, what are they trying to bend our emotions so we have this emotional experience with God? And I'm like, you realize that if a pastor gives like a rigorously logical sermon where you're just like, oh, that all made perfect sense, you realize it's your emotions that are that love that, right? It's not just your, it's not some platonic realm in your head that loves that sermon, but you're, that's emotionally engaging you as well.
Right.
It just happens to be what you value emotionally, where you might not value the music emotionally. So I think you just have to talk openly about these things. And I think also, you know, to my pastor friends, I'm always like, you should just really think about discussing openly why you ask people to do what with their bodies. Mm. And then kind of always leave room for, hey, you don't have to do any of it. Nobody has to do any of this. But here's why we've set up the sanctuary this way. Here's, I mean, like, do you turn down the lights during the songs or not? I go to a Brazilian church, so which I love, but they... But, you know, South Americans, they turn the music all the way up, so I can't hear myself singing.
Right, right.
So I think intentionality, when it gets to improvisation, the more you're improvising, the more you have to show why you're being intentional.
Yeah.
Just to help people. Again, it's about earning credibility so that they can follow you along. Because people will go along with one wacky service.
Right.
But if it's every week and it's changing, then people want to know why we're doing the things we're doing. It's not just being made up. So,
but I think Baptist churches historically have actually been shaped like a U, because theologically,
Presbyterian churches too in Scotland, they're shaped in a circle
because they want you to look at one another when you sing.
Yes,
because you're singing to one another. You know, Colossians and so forth and so on. When I heard that, I thought, well, that makes a lot of sense. Rather than all facing forward, you can actually see one another at some points in the service.
Yeah, so. Actually, the church I worked at in Scotland, the Holy Trinity and St. Andrews, if you look at the old pictures, it was all in a circle for that very reason and also for other reasons. And then they, you know, 100 years ago, they went to the straight pews.
Yep.
When they became more British, they became more like, we don't want to look at each other. Eyes ahead, everybody.
It just turned into a lecture hall.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So earlier I was asking about improvisation. There is a sense, and you can just disagree with me because I'm just, in terms of like the how we do baptism, Lord's Supper, if we just bring it to those, there's a sense in which there's not a lot of specificity. Mm-hmm. And in different traditions, you're going to do these things differently.
Yep.
Obviously, there's big debates about how you exactly do these things.
Mm-hmm. Or who you do them to.
Yeah, and who you do them to, yeah. So what... I guess I'm trying to think of this specific question, but what is the role? It seems like this is something that God has commanded, but then he's left room to improvise as we do those things. How do we think through how we improvise those things? Because I think when you step into another tradition, sometimes you have questions about, well, that's not communicating this very well. Right. We usually love our traditions and how we do it. And we see in other traditions like, well, that's not getting the communal nature of this, or that's not getting whatever it is, right?
Whatever we think, whatever we felt was most important about that for us, usually.
And it goes even to how important are these symbols. And so I've even said, I don't, people have critiqued me on this, but like if you're believer's baptism, you believe in immersion, that symbol is important because it's a death to life and going under the water. The
Romans 6 and Colossians 2.
Pictures that death that you're coming through. So if you hold them under, actually some of my hold teachers were like,
they turn purple.
Do like 3 seconds because this is your death. Right. This is your resurrection. And then I thought, well, if we take that symbol over to the Lord's Supper, it's a meal. Mm-hmm. So if you get away from the meal, then you're kind of losing some of the symbolic nature of it. So these are a lot of the questions I think as people come into churches and they're thinking about, how do we do these things? How do we do them well? What are these symbols? And this gets to the embodied nature of it. Like, I'm increasingly convinced from both your work and James K. Smith that like the way that we do these things actually really matters. Mm-hmm. But then another way, there's no like direct instructions for how to do this. Yeah. So
it's actually been one of the a couple of reviews of the book have said it is frustratingly short on instruction on what you should then do, which I thought I acknowledged at the end. Mm-hmm. Basically said, I'm not going to tell you what to do. You have to think creatively about what to do here, and actually you probably have to lean into your tradition and think about why you've done what you have done, and there's probably something good in there. Someone probably thought about this along the line in your tradition,
right?
And which is the reason you're doing it today the way you are.
Yeah, but then we'd have to do like church history.
Oh, I know. Yeah. You know what I find though? When I have students who are really fundamentalists, and I mean in the sense, not in the traditional sense of the word, right. but in the sense that like they're just dogmatic, the way their church does it and sees it, that's just the way it is. Church history is inoculation for fundamentalism, right? Because they just immediately are confronted with all these various approaches, and you can't say necessarily who's right or wrong so easily, so quickly. So I think going back, and this is, if you've never seen it, Robin Perry and Andrew Walker's Deep Church Rising. So Deep Church was the original title of Mere Christianity, and the publisher changed it.
Mm.
But they argue that the next schism to come is going to be over worship, and it's going to be because Christians don't know history. They're not biblically literate, and they don't know the history of the church's worship or why we worship the way we worship the way we do.
That's not a very good combination, is it?
Yeah, it's set up for disaster. And it's a great, great book, and I make all my church history students read that book. But I think, okay, so the improvisation issue, I would say, and here's my problem with what you said, because I understand it, mm-hmm. and I think there's something fundamentally right about it, but here's where I would hesitate,
mm-hmm.
is I think if you approach, I don't know if I say it in this book or not, but if you approach the symbols of baptism or communion like a parable, like mm-hmm. X equals X prime, Y yeah. equals Y prime, like the world of the fictional world of the thing in the fictional world of the parable just is directly related to this, right?
Perfectly to it.
Then all you have to do is decode it, right? And then the question becomes, why would you even perform it at that point if you can mm-hmm. just decode the logic of it? But I think if you look at something like Leviticus 23 is my go-to text, Sukkot, the Feast of Booths, the one mm-hmm. most Christians don't even know what this mm-hmm. is.
Yeah.
But Leviticus 23, you shall dwell in shacks or booths or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. For 7 days, you and your children, in order that you might know that I made you to dwell in booths when I brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And of course, here's the perfect, like, if you want, like, I want my kids to know that we slept in tents when we came up out of Egypt. What's the easiest way for that to happen? Hey, kids, when we came up out of Egypt, we slept in tents. And your teenagers would go like, oh, yeah, okay, cool, yeah. Anyway, so, but it says,
mission no, accomplished.
Yeah, there's something to be known that cannot be known outside of you and your children living in a shack for 7 days straight and then having a feast at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And what that tells me is that, although, I mean, think about how symbolically loaded you could mm-hmm. read that
right.
ceremony, mm-hmm. right? There's the shack, there's you living in it, seven. Well, what do you do for 7 days? Do you have to eat differently? Or mm-hmm. it doesn't say there's a lot of improvisation there as well. But there's something you're going to come to know, maybe not at the end of the 7 days, but maybe at the end of 20 years of doing that once a year for 7 days, right? Wesley Hill, I think I quote this in the book.
Yes.
That tweet, it just gets me every time when I, you know, he says something like, when I'm in a period of deep depression, going to church on any one given week doesn't help, but going to church every week is what really gets me through. Mm-hmm. And I think what he's getting at there is that there's a sense in which we don't actually get direct access to how the rituals are shaping us. Maybe looking in the rearview mirror, I think all, this is Esther Meek, all of mm-hmm. it is backwards looking. Mm-hmm. We look back and we go, oh, I see how God did that. Mm-hmm. Or, oh, I see how, I don't know if you have any weird classroom rituals you do, but I mean, I ask my students to do some weird stuff. And a lot of times they're like, why are we doing this? Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, maybe in 8 to 10 years, you'll look back and figure it out. But why would you think you could figure this out? But their thinking mm-hmm. is, I should be able to see straight through transparently exactly how X equals X prime in your thinking. And I'm asking you to do things that look mysterious or purposeless, but I know how they're going to work. Right? Mm. So Mr. Miyagi knows when he says wax on wax.
That was your best example in the book, I thought.
Great. Just, by the way, if you haven't seen Karate Kid, it's a great movie. The original one, all the other ones, who cares?
Yeah.
But Mr. Miyagi knows with each one of those movements exactly what he's doing. And I think as Christians, we have to approach our sacramental lives with a kind of sense of that always, like, I might be trying to figure it out, and it's actually trying to create me into a certain type of person and wrestle with that balance. I mean, you do eventually have to turn around and say, and that's why we don't use Doritos and Mountain Dew for communion.
Right.
And you have to be able to say something in that space.
Right. Because if you do get the symbols wrong, like if he's washing the car in the wrong way.
Yeah.
Then it doesn't work. Yeah, right?
The system falls apart. So do you,
there's some sort of line.
So how much do you actually need to know? That was a tension that I felt through this. Yeah. How much do you need to know about the Lord's Supper in order to be formed?
Should I read your controversial quote now?
Oh, yeah, okay. Sure. I forget what it was.
Here, So here's the admittedly, you said, controversial claim. You don't need to know what the bread and wine of the Lord's Supper are in order for communion to do what it's meant to do. Not only is that okay, it's necessary. The same goes for the waters of baptism. The words of pronouncement at a wedding, essay assignments in college classes, the fist my mechanic made to illustrate a cracked piston, and so on. Understanding comes by rituals of learning, but only when we look back on the whole process after we've had a eureka moment.
So I think, so this is our problem as individualists, is like we think we're reinventing the wheel. Like every pastor who starts a new church is reinventing sacraments.
Right.
But he's not, or she's not. They're actually leaning into a long tradition. And I put pressure points in there, like, okay, can you use cornmeal in your communion? Like, because everybody thinks, like, well, you just use bread and wine. But at some point, you can push that far enough. When you get to Doritos and Mountain Dew, people are like, it just doesn't feel right.
Yep.
Like, okay, well, say more about that.
So why? It has to be gluten-free.
Yeah. I mean, I went to Papua New Guinea. They don't have bread out in the tribe that I visited.
Oh, okay.
So the Christians who were there as missionaries were asking the question. So they don't have the staple food of bread.
Hmm.
So
taro root or something, right?
Yeah, so it comes from a tree
that
they actually hollow out, and they're like, do we just use this staple food?
Mm.
Or what does this mean if we have no bread? So,
how culturally local is the issue? Yeah, I mean, it's. I think it's a great question. And he had an early church. I forget who, it might have been Athanasius. Somebody asked him, we don't have water. It's in the desert, fathers. Oh, okay. And they said, use sand.
Use sand.
Yeah. So I think there's an attentive that we need to be attentive to, like, why did Jesus choose wine and bread to represent blood and flesh? I mean, I don't think it's an accident. And John, he flat out says,
it wasn't
says,
like it was the only thing available.
Yeah. I mean, he says, unless you drink my blood and eat my flesh, right? And then we know that he scared them away because they said, this is too hard, and they walked away. Yeah. They thought he meant cannibalism in some way,
it's
right?
Weird.
And then he holds... And this is red wine,
and
it looks like blood. And I always wonder if there's some way in which when you drink the communion wine that you should actually like almost imagine it as literally his blood or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, it almost seems that viscous and real and visceral when he gives it. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's a sense of where I would say, like, let's just go with tradition. Mm-hmm. What has been done, what seems on the out of the bounds. And I think what for Protestants we haven't done is think together. Why we would draw the lines, where we draw the lines. I mean, I think if you look in like the Anglicans, the Methodists, they actually have thought through this. They write about it. You'll find it in their local journals,
mm-hmm.
Their internal conversations.
Right.
But I think it also gives us some slop, right? Mm-hmm. Not the pig's food, but like we can be sloppy with it in some sense. It's the same thing I'll just point out with church structure. Mm-hmm. Like, why in the world does Paul not take 3 minutes and just say, and here's how this church should be structured, right? Yeah. Or the kingdom of God. Why didn't Moses or Samuel just say, like, okay, you're going to have a king, he's going to have a comptroller, they're going to control the money, and you're going to have the person who controls it? Nothing. You just get, like, these broad brush categories of leadership and people who need to be led, and mm-hmm. that's about it. And so I think that what I call is a kind of an intentional ambiguity creates room for you to faithfully perform this in the space that you're in. So, I mean, it actually creates the condition. I mean, if you think about it, for me, it already signals that the gospel is coming because the gospel is going to go to Papua New Guinea
mm-hmm.
where there is no bread.
Mm.
And so you have this intentional ambiguity allows you to go to Papua New Guinea mm-hmm. and not say, well, you don't have bread, so curse you all to hell. Sorry, it was a good time, but we're gone, right?
Yeah. Right, right.
Here's my analogy. Okay, so this is really dicey. This is the one this is dicey. I'm just going to admit this from the front. In my mind, here's how I see it, is Jesus takes the ritual world of Israel, packs it up on an ark that will be able to go out to sea and it'll survive the destruction of the temple. And that package beyond the destruction of the temple can actually be taken out to Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth.
Mm.
But if he hadn't had done that, the gospel, it quite literally could not go out and create Christian ritual communities, right? So Christian communities, if ritual is part and parcel of what it means to be a Christian community, it would have been impossible. We would have to be getting flights to Israel 3 times a year to try and work this stuff out.
Right, right. Just one final question. How do we bring, maybe you've kind of answered this, but how do we bring this kind of understanding in the church? How do you encourage it? It does seem like very head focused sometimes in some traditions in the church. And obviously that's not in opposition, you're saying, to the body, but how do we bring that embodied sense of knowing of this ritual and actually emphasize it and encourage it in the church? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think parents already know how to do this.
Okay.
Like, because you're confronted with these little intellectual creatures that you know reasoning with them isn't always going to work.
Right.
So you're always asking your kids to, you're like scripting little rituals for them to try and get them to see the world differently than they see it right now. So I think we can kind of lean into our natural knowledge of this that we just get from being creatures in the world who are trying to like actively not kill or let our children die. I think also, I don't remember if I said it before on mic or off mic, but I just look at people now, when my students are in class, I talk about this in the book, they come in and see me in office hours, and I am often saying, hey, let's go for a walk, because the conversation is so much better when we're moving our bodies and talking. And the physical alongsidedness, going back to the issue of online learning and like face-to-face learning, like there's something about being alongside the person and actually vectoring them, you know, walking them down the sidewalk in New York City while we're trying to also guide them metaphorically to see something about their relationship with their boyfriend or whatever differently, or the relationship to God or the church. So I really, my thoughts now much more quickly turn to what kind of thing can I get your body to do that'll help you understand this or help you shake off this bad idea that you have. And I've even thought about, this is silly, but I've noticed that I tell students to do things. I'm just like, well, if you, like you want to get around this problem, here's something you should probably go do. Like work out every morning. Just go do some kind of exercise every morning. Let's start with that. And they don't. And so I thought about getting like a prescription. I think it'd be illegal. That's why I didn't do it. But getting a prescription pad, you know, Dr. Johnson on there, and then writing out a prescription and handing it to them, because that's a ritual that that they actually take more seriously.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, the doctor wrote it. I have to take these pills, or I have to do this thing, or the physical therapist said, so therefore I must.
And you are a doctor.
And I am a doctor. I always remind my wife of that. I'm like, well, I am a doctor. She's like, you're not a real doctor. I'm like, no, they're not real doctors.
Yeah, I have a son in medical school.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm quick to remind him, there's still only one doctor in this family.
Well, I think this has been really helpful, and thanks for coming in and talking to us, Drew. We really appreciate it.
Been a pleasure.
Glad to have you in embodied form and not just through Skype or the phone.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here with you all.
Thanks for listening to Food Trucks in Babylon. The music you hear is provided by our friends at Humble Beast Records. If you like the show, please leave us a review and feel free to subscribe. To learn more about Western Seminary, visit us at westernseminary.edu.